I'm happy to be here. I'm glad you're here. That's such a pleasure to be together these 2 days and study carefully a text. But our time together, talk about our work and laugh and joke is worth a lot too. We don't all laugh and joke as much when we're at home at work. There's serious things going on, concerns, but we're away from that. And together, we just see good things and hope good things, and there's just a good time for optimism. It's great value that we have in each other and sharing in that regard. I appreciate that. I have the blessing of the lesson that is not so academic, I think that makes my job easier as a preacher and teacher. Kind of lesson I'm used to doing anyway, and I really appreciate getting this particular topic because I know everybody can relax and sit back and enjoy. The other lessons are valuable to us as preachers and teachers because of what it will help us to do and say for the benefit of other people, whether we're answering critics or answering the questions of a sincere heart who's been hearing from the critics, or sorting out doctrines of premillennialism, questions about the kingdom and the who and the where of the Messiah and his rule. And those studies are so important to us. And I think another reason that this lesson is useful and important to us is because now we look inwardly. This isn't necessarily, it could be, but it's not necessarily something that we're going to get out there and tell everybody else. This lesson is really designed for us. We talk to each other and think about Daniel as an example that we can follow. And that's really what I want to try to accomplish. I understand that I'm talking to preachers, maybe mostly preachers, but preachers, and I know elders and teachers, serious Bible students who want to step up and lead in one capacity or another. And in this simpler lesson, the point for all of us will be to take to heart the things that we will discuss because it'll make us better at helping other people. And Daniel, Courage of Conviction. I appreciate the title and the topic. I think I'm looking at men of courage, but we all want to do better and be better. And I hear that in you and see that in you. So let's see if we can take another little half step forward in that regard. The title, Courage of Conviction, I appreciate, at least in this, and that is that it kind of raised a question about courage that comes from some other sources. There is a courage that we get out of emotions. You know, love brings courage. You know, fathers or husbands, what we're willing to do. And so love, anger is an emotion that stirs and creates and generates courage in us. Fear enables us to do things that we would not normally do, things that might be considered courageous. Stubbornness and just digging in our heels and just we're not going to turn loose just because you said so and I'm refusing. And these are all emotional reactions that instigate and motivate and produce courage. But as this courage is created by these emotions, they can be misguided. It can be misguided choices. There can be a wavering or foolishness in our courage. It's not necessarily a good thing. We can think about how those emotions that create courage that enable us to do some things that really maybe we ought not be doing. We find ourselves in places where we shouldn't really be, as Peter cuts off the ear, missing the neck of Malchus. And yet, these emotions, when they're built on the foundation of conviction that's rooted in an understanding of truth, now let's put love in there. Let's put fear in there. Let's put this indignation or anger. Let's put this stubborn doggedness of endurance in there. And now we see that the courage that is built on conviction, now with the added help of the emotions that God has made available to us, there can be great strength. And so I hope that we can see some of that. You know, there's courage that comes out of our association with other people. Again, it can be good or bad. It depends on who those people are. The courage that we want to stand and on hold to is the courage of conviction. In the outline, I've got a definition of conviction. And there's no references there because this is my definition that I probably got from books along the line. But this is not a Greek definition. It's not an English definition. And so so what? I don't care what you think it is. Well, I want you to understand what I mean by conviction. So when I talk about conviction tonight, this is what I'm talking about. So this is my definition. And conviction is a strong faith to the point of absolute certainty. And so I'm using conviction that way. Strong faith to the point of absolute certainty. Paul says, I know whom I have believed. I said, that's conviction. He knows it, but it's by faith. Yeah, but he knows it. And so there's conviction. Faith that sustains confidence and determination, and let me add, over time and through difficulties. Conviction carries us farther than maybe a simpler or a weaker faith might. And so that's what I would call conviction. Conviction that sustains that confidence and determination over time and through difficulty. Faith coupled with hope that provides motivation to transcend the immediate for the future. It doesn't matter what's happening right now. My conviction, my confidence, and my strength is what is ahead. And so that carries me through right now. And so in a practical way, this is much more than just an opinion that I hold or an idea that is dear to me. This conviction suggests a complete confidence that compels action. We have to act. It compels action that's consistent with that confidence. And the action that follows conviction is regardless of circumstances and consequences. Doesn't matter what happens. This is what's going to be done. That's conviction. And so for us, this conviction is faith. It's just Bible faith. I mean, when the Bible talks about faith and it uses the word faith in a variety of ways, and I think we can see the apostles say, Lord, increase our faith. Well, I don't know if they're at conviction yet. And there is this varied view of faith in Scripture. Faith without works. Well, there is a faith. The Bible identifies as faith, but it's a faith without works. We see, well, that's not the full picture. And so Bible faith is all of this, the strength and the power that we see in this word conviction. And so this Bible faith, it will deliver us from the present. It will deliver us from the enemy, from doubt, from confusion. It enables one to act with assurance, looking the enemy in the eye without flinching. That's conviction. You know, I know whom I believed. I know what's going to happen. I know where I'm going. I know. And that conviction will never be more than faith, but it'll be so much more than what some people think they know. And so I hope that we can see in Daniel some things that'll help us in this matter of courage, then, that comes out of that kind of faith and that kind of conviction. I know this is a favorite topic, and I'm not telling any of you anything new, because in the first Q&A session, you covered most of my material. Actually, I took some notes, and so if they're not in the outline. Good stuff, good stuff. So let's talk then about Daniel's story of courage, and the chapters that are pointed out for me in particular are 1, 3, and 6, and those are great stories and events. I want to do this carefully, not to get into other material and talk about the visions, but I also want to include the idea of Daniel standing up and prophesying to these pagan kings, and as another real, true example of this courage of conviction, and then even at the end of the book a little bit. But we'll start in chapter 1, obviously, where we have the siege by Nebuchadnezzar. As the looting of the cities and the taking captive of anybody that seemed to be of value to the king. And all of that was brought back to Babylon in this complete conquering of the people of God. And then there are the selected slaves, those that were without blemish in verse 4 of chapter 1, good looking, gifted in wisdom and possessing knowledge, quick to understand. These are people that the king saw as people of character or qualities or intelligence and health that would be an asset in his kingdom. So they are not chosen because of their faith and their loyalty to the Lord, but because I can use this kind of people. And he saw that in these. And surely their judgment must have been somewhat shallow. They don't know these people, really. But they are going to be taught the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. And so an indoctrination, a brainwashing, whatever you want to say, they're going to be reprogrammed and they're going to be servants in Babylon. And that obviously is the intent of Nebuchadnezzar and his court. And so along with all of the education that they're going to get in verse 5, there's the daily provision, the king's delicacies. And so as was suggested earlier, this is a changing of culture. You're becoming a new person and a different person. And I appreciate what someone said about the changing of their names. You know, that is something over which they would not have control. You call me whatever you want to call me, but I'm not going to eat this food. I cannot eat this food. And we see Daniel's purpose in verse 8. Mark it. You've got it marked already, probably. Verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart. And we need to do that. We've got to make a decision ahead of time. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. The purpose was in place. The commitment to do right was in place. Now, what happened after that is irrelevant. His approach is to make a request. But even as he makes the request, in verse 10 and following, that chief says, now, wait a minute. And Daniel and his friends evidently have already gained favor in his eyes. That's going to say something about their character and the quality of them as men. Living in this foreign land, separated from everything that would sustain and support their convictions. Temple's gone, the priesthood's gone. You know, their peers are gone, their parents are gone. And yet their conviction remains. And so the chief eunuch, the steward, says, you know, you can't make me look bad here. And so Daniel, pretty wise young man here, says, well, you just give us a week, or is it 10 days? You give us this time, and let us eat our vegetables, and then you just look and see. And the wording in verse 13, so deal with your servants. And so what does that mean? Does that mean if it doesn't work, we'll eat it? Does anybody else, do any of us think that? That if we're not fit, if we're not in good shape, then okay, we'll eat and drink the wine? I don't believe that. But Daniel is giving them an opportunity, giving himself an opportunity to continue to serve the Lord in this world. And he says, you give us the 10 days and then you judge and then you do what you have to do. Because guess what? I've purposed in my heart. I know what I have to do. There's a courage of conviction. And that conviction is much more than an emotional stubbornness, because as you come to verse 21, thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. What does it mean, thus? Well, in this way, in this manner. This is his attitude, his conduct, his purpose, his direction. This is what Daniel did for the rest of his life. Now, if this is the first deportation, and Daniel is going to continue in this mode until Cyrus comes along, do we know how many years that is? Well, we know the number 70, right? And however we get the exact year there, let's just call it 70 years. And so for 70 years, so how old is Daniel right now? Well, I don't know. But, you know, he's going to be 70 years older at some point. So what do you want that end game to be? Did he die at 100 or 120, or did he die at 90 or 80? And then you take away 70 years. If he's 80 when Cyrus comes along, he's 10. He doesn't sound like a 10-year-old. But I don't think he's 20. Maybe he is 20. But we're talking about a young man with great conviction. And I don't think we should undercut or fail to measure the value of strong conviction in young hearts. Because they've got something that sometimes we don't have. I think I made a joke about, you know, new converts and their zeal for the Lord and how disappointed they are when they fail to convert everybody that they talk to. I said, yeah, just wait till they grow up in Christ like us and become cynical. And that's not a great thing. But that zeal and that power and that strength that they have, and we need to nurture that and value that in ourselves and certainly in those that are younger than us. So Daniel was very young, and he had that purpose, and he made a commitment, and it was to the point where he said, you give us the test, see how we do, and then you do what you have to do. Because Daniel already decided, here's what we're going to have to do. And I think they drew the line in the sand, so to speak, there. Well, God gave them knowledge, in verse 17, skill and literature, wisdom, understanding. Daniel had the understanding in visions and dreams. It seems that Daniel is the leader in the group. And that's not explicit, of course. But Daniel is the spokesperson here. He's the one speaking up. And at first it seems to be just between Daniel and the steward. But it's pretty quickly the other young men, the three, are brought into it. So I think they're with him there. But I see Daniel as the one who's stepping forward. And that's typical. That's not an odd thing for one of four to be the one who is a little bit more outspoken, a little bit more confident. And what does that do for the other three? But we can turn that equation around. How does the one do without the three? And we need to lean on each other. And our courage will come from conviction first. But we need to see the value in people to stand with us. And we've got that here. As these four young men receive this blessing from God, Daniel, on the other hand, has this understanding of visions and dreams. Suggest ideas. He is the one who has something a little extra that they had not received from the Lord. And I think that's borne out in the book as we look at Daniel's prophecies. Well, they were blessed. The king interviews them, and there's nobody like these four. And in all manners of wisdom and understanding, and as the king examined them, they were 10 times better. However you measure that, IQs, I guess, 10 times better than all of the others. And the point is that Daniel continued thus until Cyrus came. But how did anybody really know that God blessed these young men? You know, the steward looks at Daniel and says, man, you Israelites really got this nutrition thing figured out, right? Isn't that the conclusion that the worldly mind comes to? Because do idolatrous people really believe in their gods? Do they really have confidence? No, I think it's wishful thinking. I think it's superstitious hope that, you know, this God will deliver me from something somewhere. And certainly we wonder sometimes, well, did God do that or did that just kind of work out? You know, the medicine worked this time. And it's not always easy to tell. I guess when Daniel received the understanding of visions and dreams, that was supernatural there, and so there would be a greater sense of confidence. But the fact that they were healthy after this simple diet did not necessarily mean that God was behind them. But the Scripture says that He was. And I think that over time that will show itself, because it's not just this occasion, but throughout the book we see this courage being nurtured by the Lord. I want to go then, just keep it in order of the book, to chapter 2, and just notice quickly the idea of this courage to tell the truth after calling upon the Lord. And you know the story that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. He didn't understand it. It troubled him. He wanted answers, and nobody could tell it. He's sharp. Obviously, Nebuchadnezzar, the great ruler that he was, would have to be a sharp, intelligent man. And he understood the idea that if I tell you the dream, you can tell me anything you want to. How do I know? But if you tell me my dream, and we appreciate that wisdom that he had in that approach. Of course, it brought about the proclamation to kill all the sorcerers and the wise men, because nobody can do that. And that's exactly what they say. There is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. It's interesting how idolaters and atheists really kind of understand the world in reality when they let themselves. Only the gods, and not even the gods who dwell down here with us, can do this. That's well beyond us. And of course, that helps us identify who Daniel is looking to. Daniel says, let me talk to the guy in charge of killing everybody. He says, can you hold off a little while? And let me talk to the king. The king gives him some time. He goes to his three friends, pray, and let's seek for God's mercy in chapter 2:18. And the secret was revealed to Daniel. And Daniel offers out this praise and thanksgiving. The courage of conviction is going to be a spiritual thing. It's not just raw courage and determination. The courage of conviction will be a courage that's rooted in this humble dependence on God. The courage is going to come from God, and our confidence and our faith in Him. And so we ask for His help. We anticipate His good response and His help. And then we thank Him for it. And that's exactly what Daniel does here as he says, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, and the wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and the season. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals the deep secret thing. And it goes on. He says, God is great and God is good. And he praises God. And verse 28, as he speaks to Nebuchadnezzar, says, there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the vision of your head upon your bed were these. And he tells and then interprets the dream. He ends by saying in verse 45, the dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. I mean, he's confident. This is it. This is it. It's the courage of conviction. I think it's useful to notice that the king's response in verse 47 is, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal the secret. And so why did Nebuchadnezzar believe this? You know, Pharaoh didn't. What was it? Well, it was his heart. I don't think we should discount Daniel either, though, as he's already conducted himself in a way that gets people to listen. I want us to hold on to that idea as we keep working through the book, because that's something that we want the ability to do, to speak to unbelievers and at least get them to listen, to hear what's being said. I don't know that there's any record that Nebuchadnezzar decided to be circumcised and adopt the customs of the law of Moses. But Nebuchadnezzar listened to Daniel, and rulers after him did as well. Then we've got the vision in chapter 4, and very similar in that Nebuchadnezzar is acknowledging God and then is troubled by this dream. I want us to notice in verse 19, as Daniel is called before Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar knows who to call now. So 19 says, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. He was disturbed by the revelation of God. Not everything the Lord tells us is going to be comforting to us. It's not going to be pleasant. And so the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my Lord, may the dream concern those who hate you and its interpretation concern your enemies. Daniel want to tell this to Nebuchadnezzar? He's got a relationship with this man. I don't know if he loves him or not. I don't know if he respects him or not. But he cares about him. And he said, this is bad news. I really want this to be on your enemies. What's happening here? Daniel in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. There's a relationship between these two men now. And I don't know much more to say about it than that. Let your imagination go, and we have to, you know, rein it in because we don't know. But we see a relationship here that I think is something to think about. Of course, he did not want to tell the king this message, but he did. He had to, right? Of course, he's going to tell. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to hear it. He'd heard good news before. And now he knows that Daniel, he probably anticipates the bad news, and bad news was coming. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar was going to be humbled. And so the strength then to stand up when you've got bad news to deliver, when the message that we have to deliver troubles us. Maybe Daniel can help me not to feel guilty when I'm reluctant or disheartened or grieved or sad or troubled because of the news that I need to tell people that come from God. It's not all good. You remember in the book of Revelation, John was told to eat the little book. It'd be sweet in the mouth and bitter in the stomach. It's just not all good news. It's not all good news. And Daniel's got a good lesson for us there. And then in chapter 5, years later now, and we almost forget the passing of time as we go through these visions, but long time later, the feast that Belshazzar, the king, made, and they're drinking from the utensils out of the temple, and their arrogant party spirit, no fear, no concern in the world, and then the writing on the wall. And he's ready to give anybody anything to get the interpretation. These are superstitious leaders. They're idolaters. And they believe in some kind of spirit world. They're misguided, of course, and shallow in their thinking. But they can be afraid. You know, sooner or later, we all come face to face with our mortality. Everybody does. Well, he doesn't know who to talk to. And so the queen, he says, there is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. Interesting wording there. There is one that's set apart. There's a God that's set apart. We're still holding on to all the others. But there is a God that's set apart. And she speaks to Belshazzar about Daniel. And Daniel's brought in verse 13. And are you one of the captives? It's interesting. All the way through, this group of men are continually referred to as the captives that came from Israel. They were not assimilated. They did not become Babylonians. And the people never did really like them. That's just kind of the way that played out. And I hear that the Spirit of God is in you. And so he's going to give him rewards. Daniel says in 17, let your gifts be for yourself and give your reward to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him its interpretation. O king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. It's good to start in a good positive spot. And there's good news here. And God dealt with your father, Nebuchadnezzar, and honored him. But when he got out of line, God brought him down. He moves into that story. Could Belshazzar deny that? He might have to ask the queen, is that right? Did that really happen? Maybe he'd never heard that. Maybe he had heard that. But Daniel brings that back. He says in 22, but you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all of this. You lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven and have brought the vessels of the house. And he begins to speak the condemnation. As he interprets the writing in 26, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And he still rewarded Daniel. I have a hard time understanding that, but that's what happened. And we're going to consider the question, and maybe you can help me figure it out in the discussion part. But how does Daniel maintain this relationship with these idolatrous people when he keeps telling them the things he keeps telling them? And so the king dies that night. And in chapter 6, of course, he moves right into a leading spot in the next empire. Let's go back, though, and look at the event in chapter 3, the image of gold. And I don't need to tell the whole story. Nebuchadnezzar sets up the image and says everybody's going to bow down to this. And in this story, it seems to be just his own effort to bring glory and honor to himself indirectly, because, you know, this is the image of the God, but it's my God, and you're going to bow down. And in verse 8, therefore at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. And they speak to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree, and everyone who hears the sound of the horns are going to bow down. And whoever does not fall down will be thrown into the fiery furnace. 12. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Well, that's what Nebuchadnezzar had done. These men had showed themselves worthy, trustworthy, and effective in the kingdom. And I don't care what they believe. If they're doing the job for me and accomplishing what I want, then put them up there, put them up there. And of course, others resented that in their prejudice against God's people. Resented their separateness, probably. You know, righteous people will always be holier than thou. We hate the label, right? It's not a label we need to put on ourselves. We ought not think of ourselves that way. Do we understand that? But if we're doing what's right, don't people know it? Don't they, deep down, don't they know that we've stepped a step above? the conduct of their lives. And we know the result of that's going to be a resentment. You know what Jesus teaches? They'll hate you. They will hate you. And that's what's happening here in Babylon at this time. And so we need to take what comes. That's what courage of conviction will do. And so they bring these men before Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to give them a chance. Maybe he just didn't get it. He didn't want to just destroy them because that's not the honor that he wanted. He can kill anybody, anytime, for any reason. Doesn't need a reason. I can get you to bow down. Isn't that what he wanted? He did not want to kill these men. Partly because they've been good in the kingdom, maybe. But partly because then I forfeited the honor that I'm expecting from them. Their response, remember our definition of conviction, but their response was to his things, you know, understand, when you hear the horns, bow down. He said, we have no need to answer you in this matter. What's that mean in verse 16? We have no need to answer you in this matter. It's been decided. It's been settled. You know, we did it. That's the answer back there. That's the answer. You can ask us 10 times. You can give us 20 chances. It's been settled. And you know, this is part of conviction that we need to hold on to. And that is, when our convictions bring us to a conclusion, the circumstances in which we're in will never change the conviction. What brought about the conviction? Well, something other than circumstances. And so that conviction is based on those things, whatever it is, that's brought us to those conclusions. And so now let's throw a fiery furnace into the mix. Well, it doesn't change what I know. That doesn't change anything. And so we have no need to answer you in this. 17, beautiful, you know it. You could quote it, but let me read it so you can just relax and listen. This is beautiful. If that is the case, our God whom we serve, what was the question? And who is the God who will deliver you from my hand? If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O King. You see two answers there, not one? Has to be, right? He can deliver us from the fiery furnace. That means we won't die. We won't burn up. That's what that means. And that is that he can. He is able. The other is, he will. That's a different conviction. Two convictions about two different ideas. He can, he's able, and he will. You see where their conviction is beyond the here and the now and the current. What happens today is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. We stand with the Lord, and here we are. And so, it's like the food. See how we look after the test period. And then after that, it's up to you. Do whatever you want because it's already settled on our side of things. And so it is here. It's just the same. Only this is a little bit more dramatic. He is able to deliver us from your hand. Verse 18, but if not, let it be known to you, O King, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up. And of course, this is such a beautiful story. When you preach this, you know, just preach this one story. And then you can talk about cranking up the heat. You can talk about the men that threw them into the furnace and how they just burned up from the backlash of the flames, I suppose. And then the picture. Well, I'm telling the story, aren't I? Can't resist. There's four in there. And one looks like the Son of God. How does he know what the Son of God looks like? Well, he doesn't look like those other guys. And so he's amazed, and he gets up out of his chair, and he runs up close to the furnace. Now, there's a man that's humbled himself. He's not sitting back as the big judge anymore. He says, I'm confronted with something that's bigger and greater than me. And so then he calls him out. He calls him out. They have, come on out, because nobody's going to go and get him. So they come out, and he talks to them and then makes this decree that nobody's going to say or do anything to these people because their God is the God of all gods and no one delivers like this God. And so there's the courage that is of conviction. And The emotion of the day was certainly there. The friendship, the comrades, they stood there together, had to be a part of their courage. But you wouldn't do it without it by itself. The courage is that they knew. They knew what they believed. They knew who they believed. Let's go to Daniel 6 then, the other great story. As Belshazzar dies, and then it sounds like the next morning, I don't guess it was quite that quick, but it pleased Darius to set up over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. Before Scott presented his material on Darius the Mede, I knew who Darius was. Not sure I do now, but he's this guy right here. He's the one that made Daniel over everybody. Okay, so Daniel is over, was one of the three that's over the empire, and he's considering putting Daniel over the other two. So God's blessing, obviously. You know, who else do we think about in the Bible? We got Moses, we got Joseph, we've got these other characters. Daniel's not the only hero. Dare to be like Joseph too. And so Daniel is distinguishing himself above the others. The governors sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge. And that's talking about his secular work. There's nothing bad on. Nothing sticks to Daniel. He's good. He's faithful and loyal and honest and true, and there are no secrets. Oh, that we could all live without secrets. There's nothing there to find. And so they said, we shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. And what was necessary for their plan to work? Daniel had to keep being Daniel. That's all. And they knew that he would. They knew that Daniel is devoted to his God to the death. And so here's what we do. And the plan worked. And the king this time was a fool, at least in this moment of folly. In his arrogance, he said, yeah, everybody pray to me for a month. Never considered Daniel. And you hear, as you look at the story, the regret and the pain that Darius feels in being tricked by these people. What is it about Daniel that makes Darius stay up all night, worrying and fretting, fasting and praying, however he prayed, and then get up first thing in the morning before daylight to run to the den of lions and to cry out, Daniel, you okay? The king to say to Daniel, your God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. I don't think he had conviction. He had wishful thinking. He had this flicker of hope, but he didn't have conviction. Daniel had the conviction. And Daniel was thrown into the lion's den because he had to open that stupid window. You don't change anything. You open the window and you pray. You don't alter your lifestyle to accommodate unbelievers. You don't outmaneuver the ungodly. Well, let's just leave it at that. You don't outmaneuver the ungodly. They got too many tools and they don't have any rules. All we've got is the Word of God says, do this. And we're just the open book. And people anticipate our next move. How can they anticipate my next move? Not if I'm a hypocrite. And not if I'm not convicted. But if I have the courage of conviction, then they'll know exactly what I'm going to do no matter what happens. And they can cut me off at the pass every time and laugh because they think they've got something on me. Well, you know the story, and the king runs to check on Daniel, and he is alive and well and calls back, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions? Daniel said, O king, live forever. What's this relationship with the kings he's got? O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me because I was found innocent before him. That's first, right? And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. And I think he meant that and spoke in all honesty when he said he violated that ordinance, but I have never done any wrong before you, the king. He's been loyal to the king from the start. The king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded they should take up Daniel out of the den. And of course, no injury whatsoever was found on him because he believed in his God. That's what it says. No harm was found. And so the king Darius, now it's his time to write a decree. You know, praise God, he's the greatest. He decides, he is the judge of the world. And the rest of these guys can just be thrown into the lion's den. And that's the way that story ends. I want to, just a little bit time left, I want to cheat and go over to chapter 9. Because I think here we see some courage in Daniel as well. I want to back up. In chapter 7, let's look at verses 15 and 16. A vision comes to Daniel. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the vision of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Conviction doesn't mean we have it all figured out. Doesn't mean we always know what's going to happen. And we're going to be troubled. And being troubled in our spirit and wrestling with a text of God and this doubt that we have in our understanding or what's the next course of action is going to come. But we can still hold on to this courage that's rooted in conviction, because what do we know? Yeah, I don't get this. I don't understand that. I don't know where this is going. But I do know this. We keep coming back to that. And that's where our courage will hold. That's in chapter 7. Look at 8:27. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. You ever laid on the couch because you didn't have it in you to get up and work on a lesson because of what happened or is going to happen? He fainted and he was sick. And our work in the gospel and working with the Word of God and its implications in people's lives, in the lives of a congregation, in the lives of unbelievers, can be devastating to the messenger. And so let's not look at those moments of discouragement and faint-heartedness as a lack of conviction. The conviction is still there. This is the emotional response out of which courage either can excel or can be sucked away. The conviction is what is stable and solid. So that's 8:27. And now, looking at chapter 9, in verse 2, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. Not only did the king evidently take the vessels, he must have taken the law, I guess. I'm not sure how he's got the writings of Jeremiah, but he's got the writings of Jeremiah in some fashion, in some form. And his conviction knows that that is God's prophet. And I know what Jeremiah said, and so this is coming. And so what's it time to do? Well, it's time to pray, verse 4. And make confession and say, O Lord, great and awesome God, who keeps His covenant with mercy with those who love Him and those who keep His commandments, we have sinned. And he details the sins of Israel. And he says, we have done this and our fathers have done this and we have done this. And that is why we are in this place. But we know your promise is that you're going to bring us back. And it's close to time. Before we can go back, what do we know? We have to get in order. We've got to make sure that our sins, nationally, collectively, they've been confessed and dealt with before the Lord. And so Daniel has the courage then. His complete confidence is in God. You read out of time to do all this, but read chapter 9 and think about, just from Daniel's standpoint here, not the prophecies, but the fact that he takes the sin upon himself and his nation, and he calls upon God to forgive us. And the confidence is all in God. Courage to believe that God can forgive. We think about the whole, and wrap it up here. We've got 4 minutes, it looks like. 4 minutes. We've got courage in a young boy in a training camp where he doesn't want to be. Then we've got a young prophet. How young, I don't know, but a young prophet that's about to be killed along with everybody else and says, somebody's got to do something, and I'm the one. God's giving me this opportunity because he's given me the power of visions and dreams. And then we've got a man with a message that nobody wants to hear. And then we've got the three men that now are on stage in front of the whole world. Show us what you've got. These are very different circumstances. Then we've got Daniel again, the unknown prophet in a hostile environment, the party knight of Belshazzar. They don't know who he is. They don't respect him. But they, you know, Belshazzar, he wants something. And so Daniel is it. And then we've got Daniel, the target of cunning enemies without scruples, liars and cheats, who don't have any rules. How do you win? And then we've got the courage of one who's going to pray anyway. He just wants to go home. And at this point in his life, he's 80 at least, right? Does he think he's going to go home? It's been a long time in this palace or palaces. And so in all this, we've got this a statesman who's trying to do a good job as a statesman and still be faithful to the Lord. And so Daniel, in Daniel, we see courage, we see faith, conviction that stands when everything visible that gives confidence is taken away. It's just me. There's no temple. There's no priest. There's no family. There's no Passover. There's just what we know to be true. Fundamentally, that's all we had, right? What we know to be true. And that faith will sustain in unfavorable circumstances among hostile people. This is not driven by emotion, but just confidence in God's revelation. God made a promise, and I'm living in that promise. This conviction does not care what others think and how they react. They're content with what will be. And so they do not fear the outcome. You just do right and leave the rest to God. Side note, I really admonish us as gospel preachers to get that one. We need to do right and let God take care of the outcome. I think sometimes we undermine our own character and our own intentions and our own efforts to do what's right because we know that if we do this, we just a little manipulation, and we can expose those liars. That's not our place. We just do what's right. And God will expose the liars or not. So we need to do what's right and be content, whatever the outcome. And you think about all those stories. Just do what's right. God's in charge of the outcome. Be willing to do the right thing all by yourself for a long time. Oh, you've got them in your book. I won't read them all. And conviction keeps going and going for life, even though things never change or improve. Did they ever change in Daniel's life? It's just the same old, same old. 70 years of this. We'll just keep doing the right thing. We love Daniel, but we don't want to be him. It's awful. We need to want to be him and realize it's not awful. That's our task, to just do what's right, no matter what. Not the outcome, not the current conditions. We need to take responsibility and confess and ask forgiveness. We need to be willing to see the faults in ourselves and in our loved ones and our people. We need to figure out with Daniel how to love the enemy and dread their judgment and then still speak the truth. When he was troubled at his message to Nebuchadnezzar, he didn't want to tell Nebuchadnezzar that. He said, this is what I wish on your enemies, but it's you. And he told him. And we've got to do that. Taste the bitterness and the sweetness of God's message. So how do you account for Daniel's success politically and as a statesman in Babylon and in Persia? How could he be that prophet of God in chapter 10? We see again Daniel's weakness showing itself. And I think he felt this way throughout, but it's exposed in these latter chapters, 12 of 10. Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. You know, Daniel needed to hear that probably more than he did. But you know, there's a drought sometimes where we just got to stand and continue in our convictions. Skip over. That's time to quit. So let's just read the very end there. The courage will be rewarded. We come to chapter 12, verse 12. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. That, by the way, is outside the parameters of my assignment. So let's just leave that out. Blessed is he who waits, but you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of days.